You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. In this episode, we talk about books and mental health. How can mental health be covered in novels, and what can non-fiction do to improve our mental well-being? In this episode, I talk to local author of What I Did, Kate Bradley, Claudia Hammond, who wrote The Book of Rest, which is out now with Canongate, Fando Migolizana about his book A Man Who Is Not a Man, out now with Cassava Republic. Our book club book this month is Jasper Gibson's The Octopus Man. I'll be in conversation with Jasper later in the show, and we'll also hear an exclusive clip from the audiobook. The book club is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours. You can get in touch with us on Instagram at BTM Book Club and email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. I am joined in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio by local author of What I Did, Kate Bradley. Kate's new book is out now. I'm going to read the blurb for you to whet your appetite before we bring her on. Lisa is running. She has taken her child, Jack, and she has run from his father. Lisa thinks she's safe. She's found a remote house where no one will be able to find them. Lisa is about to wake up in her worst nightmare, and now she must face what she's tried to escape. Risking everything to protect her little boy, Lisa knows that in order to survive, she will have to fight. But it's hard to face someone you loved, especially someone you still love, who knows who you really are and what you are really capable of. Family is everything. What would you do to protect it? So this novel has been highly praised by the likes of David Nichols and CJ Tudor. Kate, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Can you give yourself a bit of an introduction and into your background as a writer?
Hi, yeah, so brilliant to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I hope I'm a bit of a good news story as far as your writers are concerned, because I've been writing for 15 years, I suppose, but always wanted to write a book. I remember being like a little kid and making up stories, and then being 17 and telling someone, oh, I really want to write a book, and then getting quite serious about it about 15 years ago and having to really persevere and keep going. So I hopefully there'll be people listening to this that will really resonate with. And yeah, just I am that story where if you keep going, you can be published.
And your background, Kate, isn't necessarily in writing, hasn't always been in writing. You've worked for mental health services for years, is that right?
Well, more around mental health services. So when I was 18, and I'm sure there are many mature 18-year-olds out there, but that wasn't me. I did start my psychiatric nursing training, and I worked on a locked, secure unit, where we did electroconvulsive therapy, and my job as a student nurse was to take the cannulas out. And that sort of, and although that wasn't for me, although I have to say, I would love to do that now, but I was 18 and maybe a bit overwhelmed with the responsibility of it. I then left and ended up getting a job in housing, which was a better fit for me, and still working alongside community psychiatric teams with people with long histories of psychiatric problems, and were being rehabilitated into the community, including people with a forensic psychiatric history, so those who had committed crimes. So yeah, quite a range over quite a long period of time.
I've heard that you say in interviews that you write what you know. How do you bring in your experience into your fiction?
Oh, I think when you spend a long time talking with people and spending time, and I've met some fabulous people over the years, you do absorb their stories and you their experiences. And obviously, as writers, we're looking to, I don't know, navigate the world, try and make sense of the world, perhaps. And there is that absorption, I think, and then it comes out, I think, for your characters. But your characters have got to be true to them, so they are individual, obviously. But I think it just sort of comes if you spend a long time around people. I think that comes through.
Can you read us the first chapter of What I Did, please?
I would love to. So I'm just going to turn the pages. The paperback comes out on Thursday. So this is present tense. This is the first two pages. I can't see anything. I want to open my eyes, but it feels too much effort and I'm worried it'll hurt. Everything hurts. I feel worried, I realise, not just about the pain, but about something else. I can hear ticking. A bomb? Is that what's making me nervous? No, that's not quite right. I think it's dangerous, but not a bomb. Grey is all around me, but it's receding, ebbing away, so I wait. I'm still in nothingness, but now there's a change. Now I feel nervous. It is more than that. I feel afraid. What of? I'm not sure. My thoughts are heavy, slow, and I know there's something wrong with me. Then, like a torch beam, coming closer in the dark, I realise my head hurts. At the back, this pain grows greater until it shines above all others. This is why I can't think properly. Perhaps I've been attacked? Is that why I'm afraid? I try to touch my head, but I can't. I can't move. This discovery is shocking, and I lie still in the grey soup that is my thinking. I know there's something else I need to remember. My thoughts are leaden and slow. It's very, very hard. Think, Lisa. I realise I know my name. I latch onto that. I am Lisa. I am Lisa, and I realise my right cheekbone is cold and numb. I can smell the pine disinfectant I used yesterday. And with it, I understand I am lying on the slate tiles of my kitchen floor. Abruptly, I open my eyes. With that comes clarity in my thinking. Until now, I've been half unconscious, but now I'm present. The pain now shines like a lighthouse. I turn my head away from it and see the underside of my kitchen cabinet. I am Lisa and I am in pain and I am lying on my kitchen floor and I can't move my body at all. And I am scared because something has gone badly, badly wrong, but I can't remember what it is. And if I don't remember, then I will run out of time. Is that true? Do I only have a certain amount of time? Yes. I have to be quick, but maybe it's too late already. I hear something. I wait. It's a light metallic sound, mournful. I know that sound. It's a wind chime. My wind chime. I'm home at the cottage in Hereford. Now I hear something new. I hear screaming. I think, yes, this is what I was waiting for. I knew the screaming would start and now it has. I'm too late to save him. Jack, can I remember everything?
Oh my gosh, that is such a chilling opening. So Kate, in what I did, you tackle some quite difficult subjects, mental health issues being some of them. What issues would you say are at the heart of the novel and why is it important to get it right and how did you do that?
Oh, definitely the importance of family and love, actually. And I think, well, I think at the moment we're all missing somebody, aren't we? We're all cut off from loved ones, and whoever we call family, whether it's our family or whether it's our tribe, we're cut off from them. So that really does resonate at the moment, this idea of the importance of family. But also there are issues in there, substance misuse as well. I spent a long time with people with substance misuse, and I think that we are all taking a really compassionate view to that at the moment. Any issues to do with mental health, I think, if nothing else, I think this terrible time that we're in at the moment, we'll come out the other side, hopefully with better views about the environment, but also about how we manage our own mental health, how we treat other people with mental health problems, how to keep a self-watch on ourselves. So mental health problems, family, love, grief for what could have been. So quite, there are big issues in there, but I hope it's compulsive as well, because I really need a book at the moment, particularly, that holds me and keeps me turning the pages. My concentration isn't very good at the moment. So I'm hoping it's a book that will really, if people are struggling with concentration, as something they want a page turner, maybe with, I don't know, that shines a light on something that interests them, like grief or substance misuse or mental health or love and family, then what I did is for them.
That's an excellent pitch for a book. You are based just outside of Brighton, Kate, aren't you? Who is your favourite local author and what is it like being a writer in Brighton?
It's difficult to pick a favourite one, but I do love Wendy Clark's psychological thrillers and would definitely recommend them. And I know her as well. She's a lovely person. So Wendy Clark definitely gets a shout out from me. And I think writing is just a fabulous place Brighton is a fabulous place to write. It's definitely got that vibe, hasn't it? The coffee shops and You know, there's lots of writers there and courses and interesting people and stimuli everywhere you go. So I think, and nobody ever laughed at me in Brighton when I said I wanted to be a writer. So there is that creative acceptance there. So I think, wow, yeah, we're really fortunate. I lived in Brighton for good 15 years, I have to say, and I'm only just outside of it now. So yeah, probably a real Brightonian.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us today. How can we find and follow you and buy a copy of What I Did?
Yes, well, formats are out at the moment. Paperback are out on Thursday. I'm at Kate Bradley at Kate Bradley double underscore Bradley. So that's quite easy, isn't it? Kate Bradley at Kate double underscore Bradley. Also, there's my website on my Twitter page as well, katebradley.co.uk. All good bookshops. I mean, obviously, a lot of the bookshops are shut at the moment, but it can always be ordered online. So, yeah, that's exciting for me.
I am joined by Thando Mugolozana, whose new novel, A Man Who Is Not a Man, is out now with Cassava Republic. Here is the blurb. After Lumkile is arrested for robbery, his estranged mother appears and removes him to the Eastern Cape, where he makes a fresh start, reinventing himself at a new school and falling in love. When the time comes for Lumkile to enter manhood by undergoing a ritual circumcision, he prepares eagerly for the ceremonies ahead. However, in his makeshift hut on the mountain, Lumkile realizes that something has gone terribly wrong. Having been taught that what happens at the mountain stays at the mountain, he faces a stark choice: to seek medical help and risk being forever ostracized and labeled as a failed man, or to suffer life-changing injuries or even death. This deftly written novel is one young man's intimate account of a botched circumcision and his journey to accept his fate and embrace his future as he gains a deeper understanding of what it really means to be a man. Thando, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. It's such a pleasure to have you here. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you so much for the invitation, and I'm absolutely glad to be here. So my name is Thando Mugolozana, and I am a writer who is presently based in Cape Town, South Africa. A Man Who Is Not a Man is my debut novel, but I've got two other books, Hear Me Alone and Unimportance. I'm also the co-author of Inxeba the Wound, which was an Oscar shortlisted film, got banned in South Africa at some point, it was X-rated, but it became available again. You can get it on Take a Lot or something like that. I'm also the founder and director of the Ubuntu Book Festival, which is 5 years old now, based in Soweto, Johannesburg, South Africa. And I think it has become one of the best literary platforms in the continent and diaspora.
Absolutely. It's a really, really well-renowned festival. How have you, as the director of the festival, managed to cope with the pandemic? Have you brought everything online?
So we cancelled our last edition, which was supposed to be in December 2020. And the reason for it is that there is a spirit that goes with the festival that we feel cannot be encapsulated by the virtual world. A lot of people hold and hug and kiss and cry with each other and pray. It's like, they call it a pilgrimage, a spiritual journey to go to that festival. And we felt like this was not going to be possible in, you know, via the digital world. But also, we host over 60 writers in 4 days, having about 10 activities running simultaneously in one day. And I don't know how much of that can be squeezed into an IG live, and how much time an individual might have at home to tune in compared to getting up and going to the festival. So we decided to just wait it out. We are very active on social media, so we recommend books, we engage with our audiences, and we're just waiting it out for a time in which arts and cultural gatherings might be possible without posing any danger.
That's so interesting what you say about it being a pilgrimage and the kind of like huge togetherness of literary festivals, and really just hit me with nostalgia about how much I miss them. But I'm sure it's going to be even more wonderful when it comes back. So for anyone listening that's interested in the festival, how can people follow you guys on social media?
So we are very active on Twitter in particular. We have about 22,300 followers, which is not really comparable to most festivals in the world. And you know, if there was time, I'll tell you more about what we do. So we are at Abantu underscore, or you can just Twiggle, search for Abantu Book Festival and you will get it. The same is true about Instagram and Facebook.
Right, so let's get back to the book, A Man Who Is Not a Man. This is such an interesting original concept for a novel. Where did you get your inspiration for the book from?
Well, thank you very much. I'm really glad to be here to be talking about this book. And I'm really buzzing that it's finally available to the global audience now. I wrote the book in 2008, and you know, I've answered this question many times and I've told many lies about it. But one of the things that happened is that I knew that I was into writing, and I promised myself that by the end of 2008, I want to have a publishable manuscript. So I started writing in January and finished a manuscript. I wrote another one. Finished it, and around April I thought I was really not happy with this manuscript because I know the standard that I'm looking for. And so the subject of traditional male circumcision as practiced by Amakosa came back to me. I realized to write about it before, about 2 years before that, and I hadn't done justice to it. And now I thought, let me just do a novel on it. And it took about 2 months to write the first draft. And I knew that this is the one. And where it came from is that in South Africa at the time, as it is still the case even now, around June and July and then December and January, which is the school vacation, young Amakosa boys of age, about 18 to 21, go for this rite of passage. And unfortunately, what has been happening in the last 20 to 25 years is that we get a lot of media reports about botched circumcisions, mutilations, all kinds of violence, and most disturbingly, death. These young boys die in their dozens. You know, we're talking about reports of 83 or 100 a year, and that's a lot of lives that are lost for people who are in search of manhood. There was a lot of reportage about this, as I say, in the media. Every time the circumcision comes, there's opinion pieces and all of that. There had been a drama series on television, which was controversial. I think it was banned at one point. And I thought, somebody needs to do a comprehensive account of this ritual, without necessarily taking a position of abolishing or defending the culture, but just laying it out there for the individuals, individual readers, to make up their own mind about this. But also, I wanted the Xhosa people, of which I'm one, to begin to reflect about this culture that is now stagnant, which was once really relevant as a form of socializing young boys into responsible adults, but which was now killing us. So what do we do? I wanted us to ask those questions and hopefully arrive at a solution.
Can you read us an extract of the book, please?
Okay, so I'm going to read from the opening scene. This story is about how I came to have an abnormal penis. So, there you have it. My genitalia is not the normal type. By that, I mean it hasn't got the distinctive lollipop shape with a knobbly head that most men boast of. Let me say that's not because I was born this way. When I was a boy, the potential in everything was there, you know? There are no funny stories related about me at birth. some boys get told that their willies were so small, their mothers gave them girls' names. Me, I was a real boy from the get-go, with both my balls fully descended and the promising look that I would one day own a formidable loin. But Saturn had other plans. Have you ever wondered what happens to Abba Quetta, whose circumcision fails at the bush? You've seen their sorrowful, white-smeared faces and bulgy, bloodshot eyes. You have seen their ugly, shaven heads weighed down with shame and disappointment. I'm talking about the closer boys whose misfortune affords them the costly opportunity to grab news headlines. If you belong to the 0.001% of South Africans who have not heard about or seen these boys, I suggest you consult your nearest media house. The Eastern Cape's Daily Dispatch must hold the record for such stories on its archive front pages. Call up the newspaper first thing tomorrow and write your thesis on it. You may want to formulate your hypothesis according to the following questions. Who exactly are these miscreants whose circumcision fails? What type of people were they before they were circumcised? What happens to them at the mountain? And who do they become afterwards? That's an important one. Who do they become?
That was so beautifully read. So this month on the Brighton Book Club, we are talking about mental health, and something that's so so relevant in A Man Who Is Not a Man is shame and gender. And how did you start to tackle the issues of shame and gender and mental health in your writing of this novel?
So, I mean, I was fresh out of university, so all the theories were buzzing around in my mind. So one of the things that I did in the book was to create the mind as a character on its own, the mind and the heart as a character on their own. So we call the mind the head people, and we call the heart the chest people. And I wanted to talk about the internal conflicts that occur in an individual when your mind wants, you know, to make certain decisions, and your heart is pulling you to another direction. But we see, because the mind is a character, we see a lot of paranoia in this young man who is a victim, and we see him when he's being taken out of the mountain. He's looking at this man who look fierce to him, and it looks like they're coming to attack him because he's so shamed. And they're not coming to attack him, but he's paranoid. He ends up beating a dog to death. We see how he's expecting to, so there's anxiety, there's feelings of shame, there's feelings of guilt for putting the culture into disrepute. There's feelings of guilt about when he sees is his grandfather who's really angry. And anger is one of the things, one of the mental illnesses that permeate through the book. And so I wanted to evoke all of these, but in a gentle way, as experienced by a young man. But I also wanted to talk about, you know, drug addiction, which is prevalent, you know, in many communities, particularly the townships in South Africa, where I come from. We see Lumkile breaking into cars, smoking zols with his friends, and afraid that he's going to end up in jail or dead. And, you know, you find that, you know, one or two of his friends are befallen by such a catastrophe. So I wanted to talk about the anxieties of being a young black man in post-apartheid, post-colonial South Africa, growing up in a township and in a village. But of course, another big issue was gender. This was definitely going to be a book that was going to be concerned about the question of gender, because masculinity is a very important element of that. And in terms of that, I wanted to explore beyond the dominant hegemonic masculinities that are about power and dominance. I wanted to explore positive masculinities, and these are represented in, you know, with the characters like who come to his rescue at the mountain, like Wom Den, compared to his grandfather, someone like Darin and Dayongs, who come to his rescue and even say, you are a man in your own right, even though you may not have fulfilled the rite of passage the expected way. And they make him believe in himself again. So I really was interested in exploring positive masculinities. And it is my belief that women have done everything they could. Feminism has done everything it can to dismantle this androcentric patriarchal world. And I'm not sure that that is all the work that needs to be done. I think men who are beneficiaries of this system need to commit what I will call social suicide, which is to betray this system and speak up against it. And this is one of the things that I think I have done with this book, because my own men would go to question what kind of a man writes about this. And I think a whole lot more of us need to do that. I mean, there's also the way that the women are treated. We are told that what happens at the mountain amongst men stays at the mountain. But what happens to a single mother of a boy who goes to the mountain and something happens to him? I'll tell you just one short story. The first time I launched this book in Grahamstown, I received a very long text message from a mother who said, thank you for writing this book. My son went to the initiation school a couple of years back, and I heard that something had gone wrong, but because I'm a woman, I wasn't told what it is that had gone wrong. He came back, we had celebrations, but shortly after that, he committed suicide, and I could never explain what had happened to him that he could make such a decision. And now, having read your book, I'm able to imagine how he may have arrived at that decision. And I'm talking both about the position of young men, but also imagine being the mother and being excluded so much by this practice. And it was not always like that in that same culture. So this is an evidence of a few ways in which I'm trying to explore gender and mental health in the book.
That was so beautifully put. A Man Who Is Not a Man is out now with Cassava Republic, and you can get it from all good bookshops or order it directly from the publisher and support diverse independent publishing at cassavarepublic.biz. Thando, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was lovely. And you and your book club, enjoy reading A Man Who's Not a Man.
Local author Jasper Gibson's new novel, The Octopus Man, is deeply moving, raw, and often disturbing account of psychosis. Once an outstanding law student, Tom is now lost in the machinery of the British mental health system, talking to a voice no one else can hear, the voice of Malamok, the octopus god, sometimes loving, sometimes cruel, but always there to guide him through life. After a florid psychotic break, the pressure builds for Tom to take part in an experimental drugs trial that promises to silence the voice forever. But no one, least of all Tom, is prepared for what happens when the octopus god is seriously threatened. Deeply moving and tragicomic, The Octopus Man takes us into the complex world of voice hearing in a bravura literary, I can't say that word, in a bravura literary performance that asks the fundamental questions about belief, meaning, and love. Jasper, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Please, can you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Anna. Yes, my name's Jasper Gibson. I'm very excited to be here on the week of the launch of my novel, The Octopus Man. What else can I tell you?
So The Octopus Man is based on the true story of your late cousin's Ed experience of psychosis. Can you talk a bit about the experience of fictionalizing something that is so emotionally close to you?
Well, yeah, I think it's important to draw the distinction between being inspired by and kind of basing the book on. It's certainly not my cousin's story in any way, nor is Tom the character. But what is very true is that they both had similar experiences. So what I did was really take the structure of what my cousin was living through until his sad death quite a few years ago now. And yes, that was that he heard one voice, which is relatively uncommon within voice hearing. That voice, as my character does, also self-identified as a spiritual being, and he was very much in a kind of disciple-teacher relationship, or with his voice. So this entity would flood one side of his body with love when he was happy with my cousin, and would give him electric shocks, really, down the other side of his body when he was unhappy with my cousin. My cousin also saw white light and had other kind of visual experiences, and that experience, that's the structure of that experience I took into my novel. But straight after Ed, my cousin's death, I realized that I couldn't just write his biography, that it would be too complicated in terms of getting caught up with family politics, and I just wouldn't be free enough as a writer really to do that, and therefore the character wouldn't be free. So that was one of the early decisions, actually, that instead of trying to write my cousin's life, the best thing I could do was take that experience and try and give it life through fiction.
Absolutely. So The Octopus Man is written in the first person present, which I think really added to the intimacy and the urgency of the writing in the book. Do you feel that this was the only way you could tell this story by really getting into Tom's head?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you know, the first decision was not to write Ed's biography, absolutely the second was this has to be first person singular, present tense, because I just never had that experience in fiction when it came to voice hearing. I think one of the good, the big influences on this book is Northampton's Hunger, where you're very much in mind of this character kind of staggering around Norway's capital, looking for something to eat, and starting to lose perhaps his grip on reality as well. And I wanted it to make it as intimate, as up close, as joyful, but also as claustrophobic as possible.
And you absolutely do that. So here I'm about to play a clip from the audiobook, which is read by Johnny Flynn. So before I play this, how was it for you as an author to hear such a wonderful, well-known actor read the voice of Tom?
Oh, it was amazing, really. That's just been one of the really great moments in this whole process, because Johnny Flynn's voice, I just thought, is so perfect for Tom. It has this sort of ethereal, otherworldly quality to it, but at the same time, it is, you know, it has a kind of ravaged quality. And there were some other, you know, great actors proposed, but none of them have that, both of those things at play at once. So, you know, I couldn't have been happier. And I thought he did an amazing job, particularly when it came to to the voice of the octopus god itself, which, you know, was very difficult to get right in the writing, but and I think he did an amazing job in the acting of it.
Tess is driving, looking at me sideways, trying to guess what I'm thinking about, though she has no idea what I'm thinking about. But just in case she's right, I start thinking about something else. "And he's okay with this?" she says. "You haven't been electrocuted?" We come out onto the forest tops, gorse on either side of the road. "One for sorrow, two for joy. You what now?" But the magpies have already disappeared into the military installation. "Do you remember," I say, "when I saved up my money to buy you a willy?" "Ho now, yes. How much do you get together?" "About £1, £1.50. I felt sorry for you. "Where were you going to get it from then?" "The willy shop." "Ah, yeah," she says. "The willy shop," rounding a corner into elderly cyclists, red and yellow in all the kit. She widens out for the overtake, but veers back again for lack of foreview down this barrelling Bostel lane. "So what about tomorrow? You still feeling all right about it?" The cyclists heave their way along and do not look at us as we pass. An area of warmth in my right thigh has been shifting slowly up through my hip and into my ribs. This patch may or may not be connected with seeing Dan again after all this time, and thus what he represents. A relic of my former existence, perhaps a welcome or unwelcome reminder of how far I've travelled. Tess is talking, but I can only concentrate on the warmth, trying to assess its size and intent. He electrocuted me here, exactly here, just below the bottom rib, 2 days ago. The wife. Mr. Atkins' new wife. He punished me for that, even though she is old. I've been trying to make amends. Methods of dislocation, disassembly, disassociation. Atkins has invited me for dinner.
As a male author, Jasper, writing about mental health, did you feel a certain duty to really increase awareness and get men talking more about their mental health?
Well, I certainly, I certainly, in terms of art about these kinds of experiences, I certainly felt a duty I certainly felt the lack, I should say, of sensitive portrayals of people with challenging, with severe mental health challenges. It was, you know, it was certainly the case kind of 10 years ago when this process started for me. And it's still the case now. There were some kind of noble exceptions. Most of the time in books or in film, someone who has a schizophrenia diagnosis or hears voices is either a violent psychopath or they are in the kind of Rain Man mold of a idiot savant, but maybe with one magic power. So and that's what excited me about the project, is I was kind of hard pressed to find anything that, not just my cousin, but I'm sure we've all got people in our lives who perhaps struggle with mental health issues, and they're often, you know, the most sensitive amongst us, the brightest and the best, and those who, if anything, have an excess or a superabundance of mental power rather than a lack of it. So I certainly wanted to do what I could to redress that balance.
And that completely comes across in the book, which has received high praise from people such as Lily Allen and Booker winner Douglas Stewart, who wrote Shuggy Bane. How have you found the general pre-publication reaction to the book?
It's been really positive, I think. It's, I've been, you know, very, very happy. I think the one of the odd, you know, timings of this book coming out, and you know, when you're involved in a project for this length, obviously you can never predict any of this. But one of the And there are some minuses, obviously, of coming out when all the bookshops are shut and everything. One of the sort of pluses for the context in which this book has come out is that you know, mental health is on everybody's mind, because I think we've been either stuck at home or facing extreme personal issues that have just opened the conversation up. And when this, you know, when this pandemic dies away, I'm hopeful that this is one of the good things that'll come out with it.
Can you spend a bit of time talking about your journey to publication? Because, you know, I'm sure many writers will be aware that there are lots of gatekeepers. It can be quite difficult to get, you know, maybe more niche or interesting concepts or books such as The Octopus Man that aren't kind of your standard way of telling a book. Did it take a long time to get recognised in the traditional publishing industry?
Yes, I mean, I think like most writers, I've been on a yellow brick road of disappointment and rejection for quite a long time. I've been writing professionally probably for about 20 years, but in magazines, TV, and that sort of thing. But books were always my first love. I've got a drawer with four and a half unpublished novels in there. My first published novel, A Bright Moon for Fools, I had, you know, I was very excited. I got a fancy agent who told me to go away and, you know, write a book. I went and did that with A Bright Moon for Fools. When I came back, I couldn't even get him on the phone. I sent him my manuscript. So this wasn't even before we started getting published. This was, you know, at the agent level. I sent him the manuscripts, heard nothing, never returned my calls. Then I, you know, finally got hold of his assistant one day and I said, I'm just ringing up to see if he's read my manuscript. And the assistant just said, sorry, I don't know who you are. Do you mind sending the manuscript in again? And I, at that point, I was just, you know, it was really a low moment. And I went to a wedding. I met somebody who I hadn't seen since university. So at that point, you know, 15, 20 years before, told him that story. And he said, oh, I'll read it. And he read A Bright Moon for Fools. He really loved it. He loved it so much that he thought he could agent it. Sent it to lots of publishers. All we got was rejection. It so incensed him, God love it, because he was passionate about the book, that we decided to self-publish it together. So we self-published it. We both put the money in to self-publish it. And so it was sort of somewhere between self-publishing and I don't quite know what you'd call it, kind of pop-up publishing, I suppose you'd call it. And we got a hardback out, and then and that did well, really. We were going around pubs in Brighton. We got I'm really just standing on a chair and selling the books out of the back of his car, and we sold enough and went around the whole of Sussex doing that, and London, and in the Midlands where my family's from originally. And it was off the back of that Simon & Schuster, somehow a hard copy version landed in someone's hands at Simon & Schuster, and they published the paperback. And I think having had a paperback published that way, my dear friend Crispin, who was my partner in crime then, he stepped out of the way because he recognised that this was a tricky subject. And he found me another agent and just stepped aside, although he's very much still involved in the sort of marketing of it now. And I was introduced to the amazing Claire Conville from Conville & Walsh. And since I met her, you know, just good things have happened, really. But it's so it took a long. It wasn't just this book. I guess what I'm trying to was the sort of a bright moon for fools. I think put me in a position to be able to get inside the castle, as it were, and then yes, Claire Conville is a extraordinary agent, and also was a great editor to the manuscript. Got the manuscript in great shape, and you know, and off we went.
That is an amazing, inspiring story. I love that. It's so different and so interesting. So Jasper, The Octopus Man is out now with Weidenfeld and Nicholson. How can we find you and buy a copy of the book?
How you can order it online, where you can, it's on bookshop.org, that very brilliant thing. I think is another positive to come out of COVID, where all the indie bookshops are in one place. It's in Waterstones, it's in Amazon, it's online.
Excellent. And your wonderful publisher have given us 3 hardback copies to give to 3 local listeners of the show. So if you follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club, you can find out how to enter that. Thank you so much for joining us, Jasper, and really good luck with the book.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks, Anna.
Claudia Hammond's latest book, The Art of Rest, examines the science behind our struggles to rest and relax. It's published by Canongate and out now. She is the author of Mind Over Money, Time Warped and Emotional Rollercoaster. Welcome to the book club, Claudia. Can you talk a bit about yourself and your background as a writer and a broadcaster?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the presenter of All in the Mind on Radio 4, which is a program about mental health and psychology and neuroscience. And I present programs about global health on the World Service as well. So I've been doing a lot about the pandemic recently, obviously. And I also lecture in psychology, and I'm a visiting professor in the public understanding of psychology at the University of Sussex, which is where I also went to university myself. And then I started writing books I wrote the first one more than 10 years ago now. And what I really like about writing, I love doing radio shows and podcasts, but what I really like about doing writing is getting to look at one subject in a really in-depth way, instead of picking things up and becoming a bit expert in them for a week and then moving on to the next thing. So there's something I really enjoy about having one ongoing topic to look into really deeply.
Absolutely. So why did you write The Art of Rest, and why is rest so important?
Yeah, I think rest is really important and needs to be taken as seriously as sleep has started to be taken. And I was invited by some psychologists from Durham University to be part of a residency that they were applying for at the Wellcome Collection in London. And they had already picked the topic of rest, and we got the residency and had an amazing time with composers and artists and geographers and neuroscientists and historians and all sorts of people looking at rest from all sorts of different subjects, all sorts of different ways. And what I really wanted to do was to know, well, what do lots of people think about rest? And so I ended up with working with the psychologists from Durham University to launch a huge online survey called the Rest Test, which it turned out 18,000 people from around the world filled in. And so what I've done in the book is we asked people. One of the things we asked people was how they liked to rest, what activities they found restful. And there was so much more that I didn't get a chance to talk about. And I wanted to look more in depth at each of those 10 topics to see why we find them restful. And so in the book, I count down backwards, chart style, from 10 down to 1 of the activities that people find most restful. And I think it's a question of finding the activities that work for you, that really make you feel calm. And even a short break, we know psychologically, can make a real difference to people. It can improve our memories and improve our mental health. And it's a question of finding which activities work for you and giving yourself permission to do them, even if it's only for a few minutes.
Absolutely. So I was delighted to hear that the number one restful activity is reading. So why?
Yeah.
fabulous, very relevant. I'm not making up, promise. Why are books so important in mental well-being? What kind of feedback did you get?
I think it's really, we were really interested that reading came at number one, because obviously reading involves some effort. You've got to think about the word, read the words, think about them, process them, think how it relates to what you've read before. But I think what is special about reading, and the reason people find it restful, even though it requires effort, is that it really helps you escape. And one of the things that we really need to do when we're trying to rest and to do for our mental health is to try to get away from those thoughts that can go round and round in your head all the time, worrying away at things. And books just provide a real escapism, because whether they're fiction or nonfiction, they are often talking about somebody else's life. And so it takes you away from yourself. It allows you to escape, but also to daydream. And so what I thought was really interesting is that studies have looked at how much people are actually concentrating when they're reading. And you can measure this by looking at watching people's eyes move and measuring that very precisely. And normally, if you're reading and you're concentrating, if you get to a long word or an unusual word, your eyes slow down a bit. But if you're not concentrating, which psychologists slightly judgmentally call mindless reading, then what you do is you your eyes carry on going across the page and back and forward and down and down. But you get to the end of the page, and we've all done it, and you realize you haven't taken any of it in. And so this is when people are daydreaming when they're reading. And actually, people are quite often doing that. And that is okay. Even as someone who's written a book, I say it's okay if people don't concentrate. What it seems to be is that reading provides a way of allowing yourself to daydream, and allowing your, it's almost a jumping off point for thinking about something different. And it's thinking about something different that can reduce some of that stress and improve people's mental health. And also, people don't feel so guilty when they read as when they do other things. So we found that a lot of people said they felt guilty when they were resting, but people know that, you know, reading is generally seen as a good thing nowadays. Obviously, it wasn't always. And so people don't need to feel guilty. And I think that's another important reason why it can feel restful.
Absolutely. And I think for me, reading is the only thing that I do in my whole life where it's the only thing that I do, right? So I eat and I watch telly, and I watch telly and I'll be on my phone, or, you know, or I'll run and I'll listen to a podcast. You know, there's no time, unless I'm reading, where I'm just reading. I can't do any of those things while I read. And I think that's why I find it has been kind of a lifesaver during the pandemic. So Claudia, during the pandemic, why is resting more important than ever? And you mentioned guilt. I think there's a lot of, you know, people are feeling very tired and fed up and almost guilty if they take some time out. Why is now the time that people should be resting more than ever?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of guilt at the moment. And I think that particularly, say, when we had the first lockdown, I think there was a real pressure to kind of do lockdown well, to, you know, learn to play the piano or make sourdough bread or get fit, that you had to do something useful in that time. And in fact, you know, this is a really, really horrible time. And I think just getting through it is enough, and we shouldn't feel guilty. If you manage to get through it, then that's great. You've found your way through it. And I think we've been split into groups where some people have now, if they've, say, been furloughed or lost their jobs, then they may find themselves with time on their hand. And we know that enforced rest doesn't feel restful. So, you know, people who are in prison get a lot of time to rest, but they will tell you it's not restful. And so enforced rest doesn't feel the same. And so, and then others are busier than ever. They're trying to homeschool and they're trying to do their jobs from home with all the technological challenges that that can present. And so I think rest has become even more important. And it's interesting because my book came out in hardback a year ago. And then I've been getting lots of messages on Instagram and Twitter from people saying that they read it a year ago in hardback. And now that it's out in paperback, they are reading it again because of this time, this weird time that we're having, that they're finding it restful to do that, and that they're reminding themselves of what the ways to rest are. And it is interesting because all the top 10, they don't involve seeing other people, actually. So all the top 10 are things that people can do even during lockdown. So they're things like spending some time in nature, or listening to music, or reading, as you said. And so in fact, things like socializing and all the things we're dying to do now didn't come in the top 10 as things that were restful. They may be enjoyable, but they're not necessarily restful. And so I think trying to seek something restful to still your mind when there's so much underlying anxiety and anxiety of what we know is going on around us is really important. And trying not to feel guilty, because I think that a lot of us are thinking, well, I'm finding this really hard, but I shouldn't feel guilty. I'm finding this really hard, but I shouldn't be finding it hard because there are people having a much worse time. There are people who've lost people. There are people who are working in intensive care, having a terribly, terribly difficult, traumatic time. And that if you're at home trying to get on with life, you shouldn't be complaining. But we should allow ourselves to feel sad. You know, we have losses. We have lost the way of life that we're used to having, and we've lost a lot of being able to connect with family and friends, and that is really hard and really tough. And so I think we had to be really careful not to beat ourselves up for feeling bad about it, whilst trying to look for the good things that do happen each day. And there's one really powerful thing that people can do, which has been shown works really well in research, which is to, when you go to bed, think of, and ideally write down, think of three good things that happened that day. And one, this gives you something nice to think about while you're trying to go to sleep. It can be tiny things like, you know, lunch was nice, or somebody sent you a meme that you thought was funny, or something you laughed at. But what is amazing is if you just do this for a couple of days, and I did it all through the first lockdown, after a couple of days, you start looking for the good things during the day, because you start thinking, what can my three things be tonight? And so instead of noticing the negative things, it makes you notice some of the nicer things. And that's been shown to improve people's well-being. So that's one definitely worth trying. I do it myself.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Claudia. How can we find and follow you and buy a copy of The Art of Rest?
So I'm on Twitter and Instagram, both at Claudia Hammond. And The Art of Rest is in all good bookshops everywhere, or online, and at independent bookshops too. So obviously bookshops aren't open at the moment, but there are lots doing click and collect and other ways of, there's still ways of supporting your local bookshop too.
Thank you for listening to today's show. I asked you over on Instagram to recommend books about mental health, and you came up with some great suggestions, from Holly Bourne to Charlotte Bronte, Sally Brampton to Emma Forrest and Laura Dockrill. I've included these in our Instagram highlights. You may remember our LGBT plus episode back in the summer. Well, one of our featured publishers, the Queer Indie Cypher Press, have opened up their submissions for trans and gender non-conforming writers, writers of colour and working class writers who identify as LGBTQI+. Full submission guidelines are there on their website at www.cypherpress.co.uk/submission. On next month's show, we're talking about books in translation. Our book club book is The Faces by Danish author Tove Ditlevsen. It's out now with Penguin Modern Classics. To whet your appetite, here is the blurb. From the acclaimed author of the Copenhagen Trilogy, a searing, haunting novel of a woman on the edge, portrayed with all the vividness of lived experience. Copenhagen, 1968. Lise, a children's book writer and married mother of three, is increasingly haunted by disembodied faces and voices. She is convinced that her husband, already unfaithful, will leave her. Most of all, she is scared that she will never write again. Yet as she descends into a world of pills and hospitals, she begins to wonder, is insanity really something to be feared, or does it bring a kind of freedom? What are your favourite books in translation? Let us know on Instagram at BTM Book Club or via email at btmbookclub@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to the show. You can catch up with the podcast on Apple and Spotify. And if you enjoy it, please rate, review and subscribe. We will see you next month.